Okay, we're beginning here three lines from the bottom on Pei Aleph Amud Bet. Just as a reminder, in the Mishnah, we said that a shochet parat chatat, shor niskal, ve'egla arufa, Rabbi Shimon poter, v'chachamim mechaybin. In those cases, Rabbi Shimon says there's no din about obet beno, because all of those shechitot are shechitot she'enan re'uyot. So there's a list of types of shechitot that are in re'uyot. One of them is parat chatat, and that's what the Gemara is discussing over here. Uparat chatat shechita she'en re'uyahi. Is that really a shechita she'en re'uyah? V'atanyo. We have a braita we've discussed a number of times. Rabbi Shimon Omer, para mitam'a tum'at ochlim. The para can take on tum'at ochlim. Oh, v'ayta la'shata kosher. Because they had a time period where it was re'uyah. Amar Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish. The reason is, Omer haya Rabbi Shimon, para niftet al gabe marachata. That a para can be redeemed even when it's on the pyre. So this combines a number of shitot of Rabbi Shimon, one of which is kol omet liftot kipadui dami. Anything that is ready to be redeemed or can be redeemed is as if redeemed. That means that since, according to Rabbi Shimon, there's a window in time in which you could redeem the para aduma, and it would be fine to replace it with another para aduma, and it would be yotzei l'chulin. Given that, since that was in potential possible, we look at it as if it did happen. And if we look at it as if it did happen, that means that there was a moment in time where the para aduma was released from being a para aduma and then was under the rubric of tumat ochlim. The tumat ochlim is different than para aduma. Tumat ochlim means something that is ra'ui la'achila, something that you could eat, whether it's you, whether it's your animal, whether it's a goy, somebody can eat it, somebody can consume it, then it has the ability to accept tumat ochlim. Now that's only true if you have hechsher, the kabel tuma. Any ochel, according to the Torah, has to have a liquid that passes over it, washes it before it's ra'ui, the kabel tuma. So in this case, now in this instance, because you could have redeemed the para tuma, in potential it had a shata kosher, it had a moment in time where it was ra'ui la'achila, could have been eaten. Given that, now we can accept tumat ochlim. So now Rashi, first of all, asks one question, then Bali Tosfot asks another question. Rashi asks the question, which is, I don't understand why you need this at all. A para aduma is mitamei, anybody who comes into contact with it. Anybody who has any dealings with the para aduma becomes tamei, irrespective of whether there's tumat ochlim. So why is there a nafka mina over here in terms of it being mitamei tumat ochlim? So Rashi says, V'kasha lama li kabbalat tuma hi gufa mitama adam u'bigadim. Why do you care about it being mikabel tuma? It itself conveys tuma. It makes other people and clothing tuma. It has the capacity to convey tuma. Why do we care if it accepts tuma? Rashi says it's because there are instances where you have less than a shi'ur of basar from the para aduma that would convey tuma. For instance, you have a less than a kazayit of the para aduma, then it would not convey tumah to another individual. But then you have, say, a piece of dough, some other food that you put together with it that could be mitzaref with it to reach the level of a kabeitza. A kabeitza tochlim, this according to Rashi over here, is the necessary level in order to accept tumah. There are many that believe that you only need a koshu to accept tumah. To convey tumah, you need a kabeitza. Rashi, the Shittato, many places in Shas, seems to indicate that you need a kabeitza to accept tumah. Again, there are stirot and Rashi throughout Shas, and the Bali Tosafot, the Reino Tam, seems to hold that shita as well. So here you have an instance where there's less than a kazayit of para aduma, but it together with other food items has a kabeitza. So now they could accept tuma, and it would not be conveying tuma. So there is a nafkamina, the fact that it has tuma tochlim, irrespective of the fact that it can convey tuma. That's Rashi's point. The Bali Tosafot asks from a different perspective, which is, we have a principle that anything that is going to be mitameh tuma chamura basof, anything that eventually will be mitameh tuma chamura, then in the beginning, it is mitameh tuma tochlim. Then it can convey tuma tochlim. So over here, why do you need a shata kosher? In the end, the para duma will convey tuma at a higher level. Given that it will do that, why doesn't it automatically, in the preceding time period, then convey tuma like it is tuma tochlim? That's Tosafot's question. So Tosafot says, what do I need a shata kosher for? Why do I need it to be edible at any point, or the possibility of it being edible at any point? Because it automatically should convey tumat uchlim. The Baitos would say that that principle, that something can convey tumat uchlim when it is a, when it has tumat chamura in the future, that is that it has the automatic status of being ready and capable of passing tumat. So if you have a situation in which something's going to become made tumat chamura in the end, then prior to that point in time, the item can convey tumah at that lower level, convey tumah of tumah tuchlim. It doesn't require heksher the kabul tumah. That answers the question as to why you don't need heksher over here. And it also is conveying tumah. It doesn't have to even accept tumah. It conveys tumah without ever accepting tumah. So those are the two chumrot. What Tosfot says that that principle can't do is change something that's not ochel into ochel. And that's your problem over here. The para dumah is not ochel if you could never have it be edible or eaten by anybody or benefited from by anybody. If it's not ochel, that principle won't change it into ochel. If it is ochel, then if it's going to self be tumah chamura, then in the preceding stage it'll convey tumah at a lower level. But that's only true if it is ochel. So what you need the shata kosher over here is to change it from being something that's inedible to something that is edible. Now that it's edible, then you have the other principle kick in, which is when you have tumah chamura basof, then in the earlier stages, it will convey tumah of tumah tochlin. But in that way, Tosafot over here says that the girsa here, Fatani Rabbi Shimon Omer Parah mitamah tumah tochlin, the way that we read it is that it can accept tumah tochlin. That's the way Rashi read it, that it's talking about the conveyance of tumah to the parah tumah, not from the parah tumah outward. Tosafot says, based on the way I explain it, the girsa here should not be mitama, that it becomes to me, but rather mitama, it conveys tuma to others. And he thinks that might be the right girsa over here, that the punctuation should be a shva, not a chirik, saying that it is conveying tuma. And the whole idea of the shata kosher over here is what makes it into an ochel. If it's an ochel, then if in the end it's going to be mitame tuma chamura, it's going to convey a tuma chamura, then in the earlier stage it will convey tuma at a lower form or a lower status, which is that of tuma tochlim. Between the combination of Rashi and Tosafot, that's the reason that it matters, that it's mitameh tumat uchlim, the para aduma. The way that we get to that is because of this concept of Rabbi Shimon, that kol amed liftot kipatui dami. Since Rabbi Shimon believes you can redeem the para aduma, even up to the point when it's agav marachata, when it's sitting on the pyre, the place that you shefted the para aduma was on the prepared pyre, that they're going to burn the para aduma on, because they do that out on Har HaZitim. They don't do that in the Mikdash. So even al gav marachata, you can redeem it. Afilu shachta ki hilchata al marechet shalitzim. Even if you shechted it properly on that pyre, then you can still redeem it. And that's either because Rashi brings over here, matzan na'ahimena, you found a better para aduma, so you redeem this one and you can replace it. Or the way the Rabbeinu Gershom explains it is, something went wrong with the para aduma. Oh, b'malacha, oh, b'shum davar. If you did malacha with it, which is something that disqualifies the para aduma, or any other thing that would disqualify the para aduma, you have the right to redeem it. Since you have the right to redeem it, Rabbi Shimon looks at it as if it was redeemed in that interim stage, which means it had a shata kosher. According to Tosafot, that means that it turned into ochel during that period of time. Now, in the end, when you don't redeem it, then it continues to be a para aduma. But the possibility is enough to render it ochel, or give it a shame ochel, according to Rabbi Shimon. Rabbi Shimon's view of shechita she'en ruya means it's a shechita that doesn't allow you to eat it. Even if it's a proper shechita, if you can't eat it, then that's not called a shechita ruya, according to Rabbi Shimon. So over here, since you had that moment of time where technically it could have been redeemed, even though you didn't do it, because it could have been redeemed, that means that there's a moment in time where that shechita is deemed to be ruya, because of the fact that you shechted it and then you could have redeemed it. You didn't in the end, but you could have redeemed it. And according to Rabbi Shimon, the potential to redeem, we look at it as if it was redeemed during that period of time. And therefore, there was a moment where it could have been eaten, it could have been consumed. Given that, the shechita is a shechita ri'uya. That's the question now in our Mishnah. Why does the Mishnah list this as one of these items that Rabbi Shimon says is disqualified from being otoved beno? Because it's not a shechita ri'uya. So to that, we have an answer. Amar Rav Shimon bar Abba, Amar Rav Yochanan, parat chatat, a para aduma, ain't a mishnah. It shouldn't be in the mishnah. It's wrong. It doesn't belong in a mishnah. We have a mesora that's a mistake in the mishnah, and you should eliminate, you should strike from the mishnah, a shochet parat Chatat. Now the Gemara moves on to the one after that, which is Egla Rufai. Shorani Skal, we agree that if you shek the Shorani Skal after the Gemara Din of a Shorani Skal that's been put to death for whatever the violation was, whether it killed somebody or whether it was involved in bestiality, the animal was put to death by Skila. So then, if you shek that animal before they execute the animal, that shchita is a shchita shein ruya because it's asur ba'ana'a. Shorani Skal after the Gemara Din is asur ba'ana'a. And even if you shecht it, it won't help you out in that case, because it's a shechita, sheinu ruya, according to Rabbi Shimon, according to Chachamim, it's a shechita, and you're going to be chayav in uto ved bino. Now, the last one of that threesome that are mentioned in the Mishnah is egla arufa. The Gemara says, egla arufa, lav shechita ruyahi. Egla arufa, when you do a shechita on it, that's a fine shechita. The egla arufa is not a surah until you do the arifa on the egla arufa. So if you were to shecht it instead of doing an arifah on it, that should have been a fine shechita. That's the case. Why does Rabbi Shimon say you're not chayav proto ve'bino? V'atnan. Nimtza ha'oreg. If you find the murderer, the egla arufa is being brought because they found the body, they found a cadaver, a corpse that was lying there, and they don't know who killed it. They have to bring an egla arufa. But if they find the murderer, ad shelo te'aref ha'egla, before the back of the neck of the egla arufa was broken, that goes out and joins the rest of the flock grazing out there. It's not miyuad that mitzvah anymore. You don't need it anymore because the whole purpose of the egla rufa was because you didn't know who the murderer is. Now you found the murderer, you don't have to go through with the process of egla rufa. What that shows you is that the egla rufa has no quote-unquote kidusha prior to the time that you break the neck. So that means if you, instead of breaking the neck, shecht it, then it should be a good shechita. There's nothing inherent about the egla rufa that makes it asura. So if you shechted an egla rufa, you should be able to eat it. And that's a shechita ruya. Why does Rabbi Shimon say there's no otov ebino? Amar Rabbi Shimon lokish mishum Rabbi Yonai, egla rufa ena mishnah. Here we have from Rabbi Yish Lokish in the name of Rabbi Yonai, that ena mishnah. So before we had Rabbi Shimon Baaba in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, saying that the parat chatat, the parat duma, was ena mishnah. Now we have Rabbi Shimon Lokish, the name of Rabbi Yonai, saying that Egla Rufa doesn't belong in the Mishnah as well. Umi amar Rabbi Yonai hochi. Did Rabbi Yonai really say this? V'amar Rabbi Yonai gvul shamati ba. I heard that there is a threshold at which Egla Rufa becomes asura. V'shachachti. And I didn't remember what it was. Nasvin chavraya lomar. And my peers gathered together or pressed on me that this was the threshold. Yiridita la nachleitan osarta. When you start taking it down to the dry riverbed where you're going to do the process of being orif, the egla rufa, that is when it becomes asura. That's to your question. There are opinions that believe that there is a threshold at what point it becomes kadosh. Now this is much different than a para aduma. A para aduma is called a chatat, and it has a certain level of kedusha because it's purchased with monies of hekdesh. It has at least kedushat bedek habayit, even if it doesn't have kedushat mizbeach. Still has kedushat bedek habayit. Egla rufa is not something that carries any form of kedusha. It's not something that's purchased by monies of hekdesh. It's not something that's sanctified in any way. It doesn't have kedusha that you would normally associate to say that it's asur mechayim. On the other hand, the pasuk says kaper la'amcha b'yisrael asher padito, meaning that you should bring kapara through this. So it functions like a korban, which is that it's bringing kapara. So that's the tension here in egla rufa. Is there any Isur Mechayim because it has a sense of kapara associated with it? Or on the other hand, it has no kedusha, so maybe it doesn't become asur until the arifa is actually done. So the first view that we had here was that the Mishnah seems to indicate that it's not asur until the arifa is done. At that moment, that's when it becomes asura. Until that point, it's not. But the Gemara says, okay, so then Rabbi Yonai is quoted by Reish Lakish as saying that it doesn't belong in the Mishnah. The Gemara says, Rabbi Yonai can't say that. Because Rabbi Yonai does believe that it becomes asur before the point of arifa. And the reason that Rabbi Yonai thinks that is because kapara is written by it, as we noted before, which is like kodoshim. And therefore it becomes asur mechayim. And since it has to become asur mechayim, you have to find a threshold that makes sense to be equivalent of when you're makdish an animal. And he says, it's already that type of designation that makes it like those of hekdesh. And that's why it becomes asur at that threshold. And that means that if you shechted it after you crossed that threshold, it would be a surbana, and that's a shechita shein ruya. That's an easy way to explain the Mishnah. And that's what the Gemara just said. Vimita, if that is the case, that's what Rabbi Yonai believes, Ritala Nachletan is Usrata, Lishne Khan, then you can explain our Mishnah, and that Mishnah being Khan Kodim Yirida, Kamacha Yirida. Our Mishnah is a case after Yirida Lenachletan, where it's already Usur, therefore the Shechita is in Ruya. That's where Rabbi Shimon in our Mishnah says there's no Otovet Beno. And the Mishnah that you're quoting about Eglar Rufa, that's a case before it was Yirida Lenachletan. If you sheft it before that time, or you find the murderer before that time, then that would be a Shechita Ruya, or that would go back to graze with everything. That'd be an easy solution to the problem. So it doesn't make sense to say Rabbi Yana is saying our Mishnah is in a Mishnah, because Rabbi Yana, the Shitato, has a way to explain our Mishnah. Tosafot, it says we have a principle in Kodoshim, whereby if you're Makdish something for an intended purpose, and then it turns out that the purpose is not correct or not necessary, then it's Hektesh Ta'ut, and we consider it as if it's not Mukdash. For instance, you set aside a Chatat or an Asham, and then you find out you didn't violate whatever Yitzur is that you thought. That Hektesh is not Mukdash, because it was a mistake. The only reason you were Makdish was to discharge your obligation vis-a-vis this Chet. If you find out that you didn't do the Chet, you never would have been Makdish. It's a Hektesh Ta'ut, and it automatically dissolves. So he says, why don't you invoke that same principle here with regards to the Eglar Rufa? The only reason you designated it to be an Eglar Rufa is because you didn't know who the murderer is. So now, if you find the murderer, it should have retroactively made it that it was a quote-unquote Hektesh Ta'ut, or designation that was mistaken because you don't really need it. Tosafot over here compares it to an Asham Talui. But an Asham Talui, even if you find out afterwards what the status is, you don't release it from its Kedusha. An Asham Talui is brought when someone has a Safek as to whether they violated the Avera or didn't violate the Avera. And then, if you find out that you really did violate the Avera, and you have to bring a regular Chatat, you're not released from the Asham Talui. That's because the Gemara says that an Asham Talui is brought not because of the inherent Avera, but because Libo Nokfo. You are plagued by a sense of guilt, you're plagued by a certain sense of, I must have done something wrong, or I think I did something wrong. And therefore you're Makdishit, even ala Safek. You're Makdishit irrespective of the fact that you're going to find out, because there's something that's tearing it, pulling at you. And because of that, you're Makdishit, ala Safek, and even if the information becomes more apparent, or the safek is released, it doesn't release the korban. And he says the same thing over here, that they are makdish this, or designated to be an eglar ufa, because they don't think they're going to find the murderer. They don't even have a premonition that they're going to find the murderer in this case, because they're already going through the process of doing the eglar ufa, which means that they've already given up hope of finding the murderer in the case. So that means if we do find it, it's such a surprise that we're not going to call it a quote-unquote hektesh ta'ut over here. It's as if they said, this is the Eglar Rufa, we are giving up hope, we are mitiyayish from ever finding the murderer, and they are designated irrespective of what happens afterwards. And that's why even if you find the murderer afterwards, it remain an Eglar Rufa, asur ba'ana'a, even though the murderer was found and they never did the Arifa. So that's just, Tosafot adds that additional dimension to it. That's as far as Rabbi Yana is concerned. Amar Rabbi Pinchas, Breda Rabbi Yami, Anan Mishmeid Rabbi Shimon Lakish Matninan La. He solves the problem and saying, we didn't hear it from Reish Lakish in the name of Rabbi Yanai. We heard it directly from Reish Lakish. This was Reish Lakish's opinion that Egla Arufa in a Mishnah. Now they changed the attribution to get Rabbi Yanai out of the picture, because Rabbi Yanai clearly doesn't say in a Mishnah, because he could have resolved the issue by saying it was before Yirida and after Yiridata. So they just have the attribution being only Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish. Mar says, that's a little problematic. Amir Rashi, when we were at the Beit Midrash of Rapapi, that was problematic. Mi amar Rabbi Shimon Lakish hoche. Can Rabbi Shimon Lakish really say this? Vaha itmar sipore mitzora. When it comes to the birds of the mitzora, me matai ne asarim. When do they become problematic? Or asurim. So again, here you have the same problem you have by the Eglar Rufa, which is the sipore mitzora that are brought to be mitzayar, the mitzora, are done outside of the Mikdash. There's no din of hektesh associated with them, but there is a procedure to be mitaher the mitzora. You take two birds, one of them you sheft, and then the blood goes into the water, and then you have the other accoutrements that go with it, and then you dip the live bird into it with the other accoutrements, and you release that bird to fly away. That's part of the procedure of being mitaher the mitzora. But there's no inherent hektesh. They're not you bought with monies of bedek abayit. But you have the same concept again here, where it's functioning like a korban. Meaning that, like a korban that provides kapara, the Eglar Rufa provides kapara. like a korban can help a person be released from tumat hatara, so too over here, this releases the mitzora from tumat hatara, but there's no korban over here. So is there a threshold at which the birds become asurim? Rabbi Yochanan Amar, mishat shchita. Rabbi Yochanan says, from the moment of shchita, they become asurim. So that's similar to over here, where it's at the makom of the arifa. So that the egel arifa really never becomes asur until you actually execute whatever you're supposed to do. And he says the same thing over here. The shchita is what makes it asura with the tziporei mitzora. So he has it paralleled in that sense. Now, as far as what Rabbi Yochanan believes, Rashi over here seems to indicate that Rabbi Yochanan believes that the birds never become asurim, and that the only thing that becomes asur is the bird that you shef at the moment of shkita. So that means out of the two birds, one of them never becomes a surbana, because it's going to be released, and the other one becomes a surbana only at the moment of shkita. The main part of this Gemara is found in Kiddushin. Rishonim over there seem to indicate that Rabbi Yochanan agrees that both birds are asurim ba'ana'ah. From shat shchita, the other bird becomes asur ba'ana'ah as well, until you release it. Meaning that there is a period of time it becomes asur ba'ana'ah. From Rashi over here, sounds like it's never asur ba'ana'ah, the bird that you're going to release. Rabbi Shimon Lakish amar mishat lekicha. From the time that you purchase the birds, they become asurim ba'ana'ah. V'amrinan, my time is Rabbi Shimon Lakish. What's the reason that Rabbi Shimon Lakish said such? Gamar kicha kicha me'egla rufa. He learned, just like by the kicha me'egla rufa, there's a threshold before the point of arifa where it becomes a surbana. So by the birds, there's a point in time where they become a surbana prior to the shchita of the bird that needs to be shechted over here in the tarata mitzora. Now, as Rashi points out, even though he's learning the gzera shava of kicha kicha, and by the egla rufa, we just said, it only becomes a problematic when it's yuriditale nachaletan, when you take it down, not from the point of purchase, it's from the time that you start taking it down to nachaletan, so why don't you put something parallel by the birds? He says, Rashi, mi ube egla rufa yeshla gvule asar viridata the nachaletan. Valeinu ein ben masem likicha bat shchita. The problem with the birds is there's nothing to be done to them from the time you purchase them till the time you actually do the procedure on them. There's no threshold that matches the threshold of the egel arufa. So the only threshold there is, besides shchita, is likicha. And for that reason, Reish Lakish believes that likicha is the threshold. Tosfot says that the Gemara in Kiddushin actually goes on to say that Reish Lakish doesn't think that with regards to the egel arufa. Rashi says, explains it based on that interim stage, and that's what our Gemara is doing, is explaining on that interim stage that Reish Lakish believes that, like Rabbi Yanai, Yuridatah the Nechaletan is the threshold for Egel Arufa. By birds, there's no other threshold, so therefore it is Likicha, it's the point of purchase. Later on, the Gemara concludes that Reish Lakish believes even by Egel Arufa, the time that you purchase it is the time that it becomes Asur Ba'ana'ah or problematic from that moment. And therefore, Kicha Kicha is literally purchased by the Egel Arufa, purchased by the birds. So the Gemara here doesn't continue on to explain that, and then Reish Lakish holds like a different Tana. There's an additional Tana that has that position, and Reish Lakish subscribes to that Tana and doesn't agree with the view here of Rabbi Yanai, the Tana that believes that Yiriditan and Nachaletan is what's Oseret. But now, according to this, both for Reish Lakish and for Rabbi Yanai, you have a way to solve the problem, which is that they have a threshold where it becomes Asur. And therefore, it's Shchita She'ena Re'uya. If it is a Shchita She'ena Re'uya by Egla Rufa, now, for Rabbi Yanai, and the way our Gemara says Reish Lakish, that's at the point of Yurita Nachaletan. That means that you can explain our Mishnah as post Yurita Nachaletan, and you can explain the Mishnah that says about Egel Arufa in a case before Yurita Nachaletan, and that's why it's released. And even according to Reish Lakish b'maskana, that at the point of purchase, the Egel Arufa becomes Asura, that's because he disagrees with that Mishnah in Egel Arufa, that says that you can release it to the Eder. He holds like Tana to be Rabbi Shmo, who thinks that it becomes a sur from the time of purchase. And therefore, according to Reish Lakish, it would be a shchita shein ruya according to Rabbi Shimon. And if it is a shchita shein ruya according to Rabbi Shimon, then the Mishnah makes sense over here. So you can't say in the name of Rabbi Yanai, can't say in the name of Reish Lakish that it's Einu Mishnah. So that can't be the case. So the Gemara brings in the end, El Amar Rabbi Chir Ba'aba, Amar Yochanan, Egla Rufa, Einu Mishnah. We have it from Rabbi Chir Ba'aba, in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, similar to Rabbi Shimon bar Abba before, that brought it in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, that Parat Katat is in a Mishnah, Rabbi Yochanan is also the one who says that by Egla Rufa in a Mishnah. And that's Rabbi Yochanan, the Shitato, who says that an Egla Rufa doesn't become a surah until you do Arifa on the Egla Rufa. So that means if you did a Shkita on it, it would be a perfectly good Shkita, because it never becomes a surah until you've done Arifa. Once you've done Arifa, it's too late to do any Shkita on it. That's why in our Mishnah, it can't be that Rabbi Shimon thinks that it's a Shkita Shein Ruya, because there is no moment where for an Egla Rufa, there will be a Shkita Shein Ruya. So now, Tosafot asks over here, why did Rabbi Yochanan say that? Here, Rabbi Yochanan could just set it up as a machloket tanaim. He could just say that this Tana holds that there is a threshold where it comes asur by now. We know that Reish Lakish holds like such a Tana. We know that Rabbi Yanai holds like that. So why not just say this Tana holds that, and the Tana of the Mishnah by Egla Rufa holds that there is no threshold. And then Rabbi Yochanan could have easily left the Mishnah here intact. The Tosafot says that Reish Lamar, the kach haita kabbalah biyadam, says that that was the Kabbalah that Rabbi Yochanan had, that it was Eina Mishnah, and that not that this was another Tana's opinion, but rather that the way to deal with this Mishnah was to say Eina Mishnah, that it did not belong there. The other thing that Tosafot asks over here is, why is it that we don't say over here that the Shechita of the Egla Rufa is really Arifa? And that is because by Saira Mishtaleach, the Rabbonon have a view that pushing it off the cliff, the Saira Mishtaleach, is the equivalent of Shechita. Since that's what the Torah prescribes for this animal, that is, quote-unquote, the matir for the animal. And that means when you push it off the cliff, that is the equivalent of Shechita, and you would be subject to Oto Be'et Beno, according to the Chachamim. It's clear that according to Rabbi Shimon, that won't work, because that's not a Shechita Ruya. Even if you deem that a Shechita, it won't help you, because it doesn't make it Mutar Ba'ana, it doesn't make it Mutar Ba'achila. So why don't you invoke the same principle here with regards to Egla Rufa? Say that the Shechita in the Mishnah doesn't mean literally Shechita, it means the Arifa. And the Chachamim deemed the Arifa of Egla Rufa like a Shechita. That's the matter. That's what needs to be done to this animal. And therefore you'd be subject to Oto Be'et Beno if you shech the child of this animal because you did an Arifa, which is the Shechita for the Egla Rufa. And Rabbi Shimon will disagree because he thinks that you need Shechita HaRuya, and Arifa doesn't make it Ruya LeAchila. Therefore it can't be a deemed Shechita. And that'd be an easy way to solve the problem in our Mishnah. So the Rabbeinu Tam in the end says that the Gemara didn't go that way because the Mishnah says Bishachat, that it actually says that he did a Shechita and not Arifa. That's why the Gemara doesn't explain it that way, although Tosafot pushes back against that explanation of the Rabbeinu Tam and says maybe the reason that it wrote Shechita is for the other cases in the Mishnah where Shechita is relevant as opposed to the case of Egla Arufa. Although the truth is that once you eliminate Parat Chatat from the Mishnah, there are only two cases in the Mishnah. There's Shor HaNiskal and Egla Rufa. Once you've done that already, then the Shor HaNiskal needs Shechita, Egla Rufa would have been Arifa. You may as well have used Shochete the Shor HaNiskal, but already Feta Egla Rufa. That's probably the way you should have said it, because it's not like there's a whole list of things that need Shechita versus the Egla Rufa, and therefore it's just subsumed in it. It's one and one, and therefore it's not necessarily a reason to write a Shochete over there. So that's what the Rabbeinu Tam explains why the Gemara didn't go in that direction. Now the next Mishnah. Shnaim shlachu para ubina. Two people who purchased a para and its child. Ezo shlakach rishon yishkot rishon. The one who purchased first has the first right to shech. So if he shechs, then the other person can't shech that day because it's boto yom. So he has to wait until the next day. So he gains that right. Vim kadam hasheni zaka. The second one jumps the gun and shechs, then what's done is done and the first one can't shech on that day. So Amar Rav Yosef, the Inyan Dina Atznan. Our Mishnah is a monetary statement, not a din and isur v'heter. Not that it's a sur for the second one to shech before the first one. It doesn't matter, really. In terms of isur v'heter, whichever person shechs first, then they are a good shechita. The second one then is precluded from shechting on that day. There's nothing inherently in terms of isur v'heter that the first one has to be first. It's a din and dinei mamononot, which means that if both of them say they need to shecht it today, if the first one takes the second one to Beit Din, Beit Din will enforce that the first one has the right to shecht it and not the second one. And that is based on the Tosefta, as Rashi says over here, which is, in the Tosefta, if you purchase an animal from the Balabayit, you have the right to shecht it that day, and the Balabayit can't shecht the second animal that day. Because when he sold it to you with the understanding that you're going to shecht it on that day. And that means that he's precluded from shechting on that day. And you have rights to shecht and not him. He can't shecht that day because he knows he sold it to you to be purchase kreita. And that's part and parcel of the sale. Therefore, since the balabayit himself, with the animal that you leave behind, doesn't have a right to shecht it, when he sells that animal to another party, he can only sell the rights that he has. The rights he has are subordinated to your right to shecht first. And just like he is subordinated to you, when he sells it to the other party is also subordinated to you. So Tana, we have a Tosefta. If the second one shechted first, then he jumped the gun, and he benefits from this. Rashi says, very strangely, Zariz v'niskar means, niskar yesh lo revach, shokel yom basar. He's the beneficiary of the fact that he can eat his meat today because he jumped the gun and shechted it first. That seems very strange because, in terms of monetary rights, he didn't have the right to do that. So now that he went ahead and jumped the gun and did it, we're going to call him a niskar and a zariz. That seems to be a little bit strange. It could be that they're just bringing the tosefta to show there's no issue of Easter v'heter over here, because you can't speak about a zariz v'niskar if it was a sur to shecht the second one today. So that's why they're just using that to prove that it's monetary in nature. Or, we'll see in a second that the taz and the shaf argue in the Shulchan Aruch as to what the meaning of zariz v'niskar means over here. Zariz, dolo abadi sura. He's a zariz because he didn't do anything wrong. Viniskar, the achal visra, that he's eating the meat today. The Taz comments on this and says it's not possible that you can take this literally because the word zariz usually is a positive term in the Gemara. Now, if you jumped the gun and you shecht it when you were the second buyer, that means that you impinged on the rights of the first party. Why would you be called a zariz? Why would you call it niskar? So the Taz says that there are actually two different scenarios over here. The first scenario is a case, like in our Mishnah, is a case where you bought from a single individual. One seller sold to party number one, the mother, and then sold to party number two, the child. In that case, the second individual does not have a right to jump the gun, and it wouldn't be called a zariz v'niskar. Then, if there are two owners over here, one person owns the mother, one person owns the calf, and they both sold on the same day, in that case, neither party has a right over the other. As we said before, the whole reason that you have rights over here is because when the balabait kept the animal, he sold you the rights to shecht and subordinated that second animal to your rights. Then when he sells it to the second party only can buy whatever the balabait had. The balabait had subordinated rights. On the other hand, when you have two parties selling, one selling the mother, one selling the child, then neither party is subordinated to each other. And therefore, it's open season. Whoever shechts first wins the lottery over there because either party has a right to shecht first. And you shecht first, you're zariz v'niskar. You're the beneficiary of being quick and having alacrity because you'll be able to eat it today. And you didn't do anything wrong. You didn't do an avirah. That's how the Taz deals with it. The Shach, on the other hand, says that you just have to explain the word zariz over here differently. It doesn't mean zariz in the classic sense of zariz. But rather, zariz is once it's done, it's done. Meaning that you can't change the fact that he shecht it, even though he didn't have the right to shecht it. He was a zariz and he did it. Then he didn't violate any isurim. He might have impinged on the other person's monetary rights, but the animal is not a sur, and the other party can't shecht anymore that day. So zariz is used in that sense, not in the positive sense, but just in a description of what happened over here if he did this. Not that we would encourage it, and not that he has a right to do such. That's a machlok between the Taz and the Shach as to whether the case here being brought in the Tosefta is a case where it's dealing with two sellers, or is even with a single seller, when someone's not doing the right thing, but he's still called a zariz v'niskar in this case. All right, next Mishnah. Shechat para v'achar kach shnei baneha. You shecht a para, and then afterwards two children, two offspring of that para, sofek shmonim. You're chayav twice, proto ve'ed beno. One time for each of the children that you shechted. So you'll end up with 80 lashes, two sets of malkot. Shechat shnei baneha v'achar kach shachta. On the other hand, if you shecht the two children first, and then afterwards, check the mother, sofeget arbaim. Then you only get 40 lashes in that case, because you only violated one isur when you shechted the mother. The mother is a single isur, even though there are two applications of the isur, because the children were shechted first. Nevertheless, it's the same isur, which is beno v'oto. You can't shecht on the same day. Shechta ve'et bita, ve'et bat bita. You shechted the mother, then the child, then the grandchild, sofek shmonim. Over there, you're then in violation of two separate times of oto ve'ed beno. The mother, then the child. You shechted the child, you're in violation of oto ve'ed beno, vis-a-vis the mother and the child. Then when you, after that, shecht the grandchild, you're in violation of oto ve'ed beno for the child, vis-a-vis the grandchild. So it's two separate violations of Oto Ve'Beno. Therefore, Sofeget Shmonim, you're going to get 80, two sets of Malkot, because you violated the Isser two separate times with two separate entities. Shachta Ve'et Bat Bita. If you shach the mother and the grandchild, V'achakach Shachat Bita. And then you went back and shechted the child, which was in between the mother and the grandchild. So Ve'et Arbaim, you get 40 lashes then, because you are with a single entity in violation of two problems. You're in violation of the problem of Oto Ve'Beno, but you're also in violation of the problem of Beno Ve'Oto. So you're not allowed to, we're going to see in a second in the Gemara, shecht either direction. You're not allowed to shecht the mother and then the child, or the child and then the mother, either way. So over here, you're in violation of both directions, but you only did it on a single entity, which is the one that you shechted. And therefore, according to the Tanakam and the Chachamim, you only chayav arbaim. Sumcha somor mishum Rabbi Meir, sofek shmonim. Sumcha says that you're chayav shmonim because you were in violation of two isurim over here. You're in violation of oto ve'beno, and you're in violation of buno ve'oto. Now, it is possible that you could say that Sumcha only says this because over here, they were two different actions that led you into this problem, which is that you shechted the mother and you shechted the grandchild. So then when you shechted the child in between, you had two actions that led you into this problem, and therefore you're going to be chayav shtayim over here. That's the way you could explain it. Whereas if you're only in a either single violation or single violation didn't involve two separate entities beforehand, maybe in that case you would only be chayav arbaim, even according to Sumkos. We're going to see that that's not the case. And Tosfot says over here, you can see it already, Aresha Nami Polik, Kedepirish Bakuntris. Sumkos argues even on the Resha. And on the Resha, in the case where you had the two children shefted first, and then you shefted the mother, you're going to be chayav shmonim according to Sumkos. You see from that that Sumkos believes that not only when it's two entities that are shefted and two different isurim, even if it's the same isur, as long as there's two entities involved, that's enough to be mechayev yushmonim. So even in the case in the Resha, he'll argue. Question is now, what happens if there aren't two entities over here and not two shemot? What's the din over there? Which we're going to see the Gemara try to extrapolate Sumkos. At least according to the way the Tosafot and the Rashi learn over here, Sumkos argues on the Resha as well. Gemara says, Amai, why are you chayav when you do it out of order? Oto ve'beno amai rachmana, velo beno ve'oto. You can't say that the order doesn't matter. The Torah specifies oto ve'beno, it and its offspring you can't shecht on the same day. That makes it sound like that there is an order to what has to happen over here. Lo salchadatka, you wouldn't think this way. Titanya, because we have a bright oto ve'beno, inli oto ve'beno. The pasuk says oto ve'beno makes it sound like the parent then the child. Oto ve'et imo minayin. How do I know if it's the child then the mother is also problematic? Shuomer lo tishchatu. When it says in plural lo tishchatu or ikan shnayim, there's two instances where you're going to be chayav. There are two types of shchita that can make you chayav over here. Haketsa. Where is there a manifestation of where two shchitot can make you chayav? Echad shochet et apara, v'achad shochet et ima. Person that shechs a para, and then another party shechs the mother, and then another party shechs the daughter, both of the latter parties are chayavim. So again, in our case where you have the mother, child, and grandchild, if someone shechted the child, which was perfectly fine, if two other parties then come, one shechs the mother, and one shechs the grandchild, each of those two parties is going to be chayav. And that's the explanation of the word lo tishchatu, that there is a double restriction. After you've shechted an animal, there are actually two restrictions that remain. Those two restrictions are mother of that entity that you shechted, and daughter or child of that entity that you shechted. Both of those are going to be restricted, and that's how you know it applies in both directions. Gemara says, hami bailu gufei. What do you mean? You need the lo tishchatu for the din itself, which is to teach you only shchita is problematic by oto ve'beno. Gemara says, im ken lichtov lo tishchot, my lo tishchatu. If that was the case, why does it write it in the plural? Let it write it in the singular. Then you would have known the din of shchita. Now it writes the lo tishchatu in plural. That teaches you that two parties are chayav afterwards. Ve'kademi ba'ile. I still need it for a din. De'ikot of rachmana lo tishchot. Had it written in the singular, havamina chad in trelo. that only if one person checks both animals are you chayav. But if one party shechted the son or daughter and one shechted the mother, maybe in that case they would not be chayav because it says tishkot in the singular. That's why I need lo tishkatu, tishkatu in plural, to teach you that it doesn't matter if it's one party or two parties violating oto ve'epino. Both of them will be held culpable in that case. Whether it's the party who shechted the mother, or whether it's not the party that shechted the mother, both of them are chayav for shechting the child. Lo tishkatu teaches you that even another party that shechts the child will be held culpable over here. Imkain, if that was the case, lichtov. So there are different versions of what should have been written here. Imkain lichtov, lo yishachatu is one possibility. Or the way that the Mar of Mironchenberg says is, lo yishchetu. Either way, it means that in the passive form, it could have been written, my lo tishchatu, which makes it sound like that they're actively doing a shchita. It's not like in the passive form in the verb, which means if a shchita is done by whomever, that you'll be chayav, which would have indicated that if it's the same party that shechted the first, or it's not the same party that shechted the first, you're going to be chayav. Here, when you have the active, lo tishchatu, means sounds like two active shchitot are going on, and that's why there's a violation over here. Shema mina tarti. From there, you can learn two things. So you have a number of dinim that are learned from the word tishchatu. One is that shchita is the only thing that is asur by oto ve'epino. Number two is, even if it's a different party that's shechting the second animal, they are still culpable, even though they didn't check the first animal. And the third din, which is the din of our Mishnah, is that it doesn't matter which direction it's going in. It doesn't matter if it's oto ve'epino, or it's v'no ve'oto. Either way, you are chayav. And that's the source for that din. Right now, the Gemara moves on. Shachata ve'bat bita. In the case where you shechted the mother and the grandchild, and then afterwards shechted the daughter in between, the Chachamim say 40. Rav Sumkus, in the name of Rabbi Meir, says 80. Amalei Abai the Rav Yosef, my time of the Sumkus. What's the reasoning behind Sumkus' position? Kutsavar Sumkus, does Sumkus believe, Achal shnei zeitei chelev, ve'alem echad chayav shtei chatot? Does Sumkus believe that anytime there are multiple violations, that you're automatically chayav multiple times, even ve'alem echad, even if it's one forgetting? So generally, when you have one forgetting and you have multiple violations, we all consider that to be one violation because it was one forgetting over here. That was the whole shogeg that you had, and you bring one chatat. Maybe Sumkus disagrees with that and says, when you eat multiple pieces of chalev, when you forgot, you're going to be chayav chatat on each one of those pieces of chalev that you ate. Is that the view of Sumkus? And that's the reasoning in our Mishnah as well, which is the fact that you're chayav twice because you two violations over here. Doesn't matter that it was done through a single entity. It's irrespective of being a single entity. It's the same chaylev over here, the same forgetting, and yet we're going to make you chayav multiple times. So too, when you shecht the animal that has a mother that was already shechted and a daughter that was already shechted, so there you're going to be chayav twice as well. Even though it's one action, you're going to be chayav multiple times. And then, ubedinu delishmina ba'alma. And Sumkus could have told us this din in any other halacha, like in the case of chaylev. So then why did it mention this machloket in our Mishnah in particular? To tell you the dissenting opinion against Sumchus that says, even though over here you have gufim mechulakim, which is the mother was shechted and the granddaughter was shechted first, which were gufim mechulakim, patrei rabbanan. The rabbanan still say you are patur in this case. So despite the fact that there's gufim mechulakim, nevertheless, you only chayab once according to the Chachamim. Because the action that you take in the end is a single action. And either because it's a single action, or because oto ve'epino, v'no oto, derived from the same isur, either one of those make it into a single violation and not a multiple violation. So for one of those two reasons, you only chayav once. The reason they brought it in our context is to teach you the power of the Chachamim that they disagree even in this context. So then that's one possibility we had to explain Sumchus. Or the other possibility is, Odilma kasar Sumchus, Akal shnei zeitei chelev ve'elam echad enu chayav alachat. So maybe Sumkus believes that when you eat two zeitei chelev, you're only going to be chayav once for that. And the reason over here is, everybody agrees that if you do the same violation with multiple people, then you're still chayav. So for instance, if a person sleeps with five different nidot, then the person's going to be chayav five times, even if it's in one forgetting, even though it's the same violation, because you have gufim mechulakim, even the chachamim are going to agree in this, in that case. In our case, it's a little different version of gufim mechulakim, either because oto ve'beno ve'beno oto are two separate dinim, and you can see that in the Rabbeinu Gershom, what he says, klomar, kevan dechlau shnei yisurim b'shchita achat, since he covered two yisurim in one shchita, hafagav de'ika oto ve'beno u'beno be'oto, so even though there are two shemot over here, since it was a single action, we don't consider the two shemot as to be independent. That's how he says it. He calls it shemot mechulakim. Even though you have shemot mechulakim, you don't really have kufim mechulakim. Even though the Gemara calls it kufim mechulakim, really means shemot mechulakim, two isurim. According to Rashi and the Tosafot, it means the thing that led into the isur involved two separate actions, and therefore your action now is connected to those two separate actions that he made before, which was the mother and the granddaughter. And therefore, we view it as being two separate violations, even though now you're only shechting one item. So maybe that's their machloket. And if that's the case, that's what Rashi and Tosfot said on the Mishnah. Some folks would disagree even in the first case in the Mishnah, which is when you have two children that are shechted first, and then the mother is shechted. There you also will be chayav twice, because those are gufim mechulakim, according to this. According to the Beinu Gershom, that would not be the case, because he said that's not Shemot Mechulakim over there, you're only Chayav for Beno Veoto, and both of them are the same violation. So according to him, Sumkos would not argue on the ratio. According to Tosfot and Rashi, Sumkos would argue on the ratio. So that's the way that Sumkos will explain it, as opposed to Shnei Chzeitei Chelev, where it's all the same violation and the same action, so over there, you're not going to be Chayav multiple times. Amalei in. Rabbi Yosef says back to his Talmud Abaye, yes, first way he explained it is correct, and Sumkos believes that even when you add two zeitei chelev behelam echad, you're going to have chayav shtei chatot. Mimai, how do you know that's the case? Mid it's not, because we have a Mishnah, probably is a Braita, has zoreya kilayim kilayim lokeh. Someone who plants kilayim, kilayim, sounds like twice, he gets malkot. My lokeh, what does it mean that he gets malkot over here? Ilay malokeh achat. If you tell me that he gets one set of makot, pshita, why do you need to tell me that? If you violate an isra that you're going to get makot, that's not any chiddush. Gold, my kilayim, kilayim. And then why mention kilayim twice? Ella pshita, what's the case here? Beit malkiot, that you're going to get two sets of makot. But my eskina, what's the scenario? Ilema bezeh acharzeh ubishtei hatraot. If you're talking about it, we've done sequentially. And each time the person was warned not to violate kilayim, tanina. We already have it in a Mishnah, which is Nazir, Shaya Shote Yayin Kol Yom. If you have a Nazir that was drinking wine all day, Enu Chayav El Achat. He is only Chayav once. Amrulo, Al Tishtev Ushote, Al Tishtev Ushote. You warn him and say, don't drink any drinks. Don't more drink any drinks. Then Chayav Kol Achat Achat. You're Chayav on every single one. We already have a Mishnah that tells you explicitly if you give multiple Hatrot and you have multiple violations, you're going to be chayav on each violation. So why do I need a brayta to tell me that? Tosafot is bothered by this, and he says, braytot all the time repeat things that are found in the Mishnah. That's the whole reason it's a brayta, is because it's something that is similar to a Mishnah. It might explicate on the Mishnah, but it repeats things in a Mishnah. So what that we have this in a Mishnah? You have a brayta that's saying the same din. It doesn't matter that it's in a Mishnah. So Tosafot says that brayta are really explications on the Mishnayot. Therefore, if the brayta was really speaking about this case, it should have used the same example as the Mishnah. The fact that it uses a different example is already an indication it must be a different case. Elav shita, bevat achat, ubetra achat. It was one warning and done simultaneously. Tosafot just explains that pshita, bevat achat, ubetra achat means ubetra achat. Either bevat achat, you did it simultaneously, or you did it sequentially, but only had one hatra'ah. It's actually two cases over here, because in both of those cases, the chachamim are poter. It doesn't need to be both bat achat and hatra'ahat. You don't need both of those in order for the chachamim to be poter over here. Mani, who says in that scenario that you're going to be chayav twice? If it's the rabbonon in our mission that argue on sumkos, over there where it's different, either, again, from the Rebbeinu Gershom perspective, two shemot, where it was two different isurim, they said over there you only chayav once. Or if you say gufim mechulakim, means that it was different entities that caused the problem. Over here where there's only one violation, which is kilayim, or it's the same action that you're taking, that's kilayim, then of course you should only be chayav once. Why would you be chayav twice?
Elalav Sumchosi. So it must be that it's authored by Sumchos. And you see here that Sumchos believes that when you violate something twice under one hashraha, you're going to be chayav twice. So that's how Rav Yosef proves to Abaye that that's the view of Sumchos. And that his view is much broader than simply the case over here where it's Gufim Mechulakim. It's a general position that multiple violations result in multiple punishments, irrespective of how many times you got the hatra, even with hatra batachat. Mar says, lo, the olam rabbonon. It's authored by the rabbonon. Umilta agav orche kamash malan. And it's teaching us something as an aside. De'ika trei gavne kilayim. That there are two different violations of kilayim. Ulafuke min derabdur aboshia. And it comes to contrast or dispel the position of Rabboshia, Dama Rabboshia, Achizra, Chita, Visoura, Vichartzan, Bimapolet Yad. In order to be in violation of Kilea Kerem, according to Rabboshia, according to Rabbi Oshaya, you have to actually have Chita, Seora, and Chartzan. Chartzan are grape seeds. So in order to be in violation of Kilea Kerem, not only do you have to plant something with the grape seed, you also have to have other kilayim in that mix. And that's because it says, lo tizra karmacha kilayim. So he learns from that, you may not plant in your kerem, where there are already grape seeds or vines, kilayim, something else that is kilayim. And that means that you have to have kilayim independent of that which is being planted along with the grapes. Therefore, he requires you to have three different seeds in your planting. Both itatsora, which is kilayim, and then in addition to that, the Kilei HaKerem, the Chartzan, in order to make a Kilei HaKerem. That's the view of Rabbi Yoshia. Kamash Malan. So from there we see, and that's what the Milta Agav Orche is, the Chi Zara, Chita V'Chartzan, O Se'ora V'Chartzan, Nami Mechayev. If you plant both Chita V'Chartzan, or you plant Se'ora and Chartzan, you don't need all three of them to be in violation of Kilei HaKerem. Now, that's the girsa of the Shita Mekubetzet, and that might relate to something that Tosfot speaks about over here, which is that the Tosfot says that kilayim and kilayim means that with your right hand you put down chitzora and chartzan, and with your left hand you put down chita and chartzan. According to the Chachamim, you'll be chayav for kilei hakerem for the chita and the chartzan. And chitzora and chartzan, two sets of malkot. Because according to Rabbi Yoshia, for the chita and chartzan, or chitzora and chartzan, you're not going to be chayav. Tosfot says that he doesn't think that's right because those are too similar to each other, because those aren't considered to be kilei zra'im because they're not differentiated enough. They're both the same violation, and you'd only be chayav once. Because according to the Reed, you're chayav kilei zra'im when you have chita and se'ora. You're not chayav for kilei zra'im when you have chita and chartzan, or se'ora and chartzan, and that's because the chartzan is not called a zera, and therefore it's lo tizra kilayim doesn't apply to it. But if you have chita and sora, it will apply to it. Chita and sora are considered to be shnei zra'im, and therefore they are kilayim one with the other, and Rabbi Yoshia will agree with that. By chatzan and chita, or chatzan and sora, according to Rabbi Yoshia, those are not called two zra'im, and therefore there's no kilayim over there. And therefore if you have lo tizra karmacha kilayim, you have to bring kilayim, which is chita sora, together with the kerem, in order to be chayav. And that's why Tosfot says, kilayim and kilayim means that with your right hand you put down chita and sora, and with your left hand, you put down chita and chartzan. So that case, you're chayav for kilei zra'im because of the chita and sora, and you're chayav for kilei akerem because of the chita and the chartzan. In that instance, Rabbi Yoshia would say you only chayav one, which is kilei zra'im and not the kilei akerem. And that's the point of the Braita, is to teach you that the Chachamim believe in that case, that you're in violation of two different kilei, two different forms of kilayim, kilei zra'im and kilei akerem. And that's because you planted chita v'sora and chartzan over here. Chita and sora are problems of kilei zra'im, which even Rabbi Yoshia would agree with. And you have the chita and chartzan, which would create the kilei akerem, which Rabbi Yoshia would not agree with, but that is the view of the Chachamim. And that's why Tosfot says the case is that you have chita and sora in one hand, and then either chita v'chartzan or sora v'chartzan in the other hand, and not that one hand has chita v'chartzan and the other one sora v'chartzan, because he doesn't think there's any kilei zra'im, elim kein it's chita and se'ora. And that's why the Gemara over here concluded that it is chita v'chartzan, o se'ora v'chartzan. That's where he says you're not chayav. But had it been chita v'se'ora, in Ochanami, that Rabbi Yoshia would have agreed that there is a problem with kilei zra'im.
That's why you can't say chita b'sora v'kartzan and say that the chachamim mean your chayav twice, once for gilei hakerem and gilei zraim. And Rabbi Yoshia disagrees, but it's not true. Because in that case, he also would agree that your chayav for gilei hakerem and gilei zraim. So that couldn't be the case through the example that's brought by the Gemara. And even though it's a little strange now, because you're bringing down a braita in order to teach you something agav. The whole point of the braita, or the main theme of the braita, is not meaningful. It's only the agav that is meaningful over here. They did that because the agav, it can only be learned from this case. So the point is that it didn't mimic the Mishnah's case of Nazir, because then it couldn't teach you the other issue, agav. So it taught it to you in this form or this fashion in order to benefit from the fact that you also get this additional information if you make the scenario this way instead of the scenario of Nazir. And that's what it means, agav. Now the Gemara says, Tashma. Let's try to figure out Sumchus's position from somewhere else. Rav Yosef's proof as to what Sumchus's position was undermined over here. So let's look at it from a different perspective. Tashma. Achal mizek kazayit umizek kazayit sofek shmonim. Get a kazayit from this and a kazayit from that, you get 80 malkot. This is a reference to something later on in the Masechta with regards to Gidon Asher. You ate a kazayit of the Gidon Asher from the right leg, and you ate a kazayit of the Gidon Asher from the left leg, you get 80 malkot. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Inu Sofeg Ela Arbaim. You only get 40. You're only in violation once. Hey, Chidami, what's the scenario? If it is sequential, you ate one kazayit, and then you ate another kazayit, and in each one of them you got a hatra for, my time at the Rabbi Yehuda. What's the reasoning behind Rabbi Yehuda? Hatrat safeki. Shemina le Rabbi Yehuda, the ma hatrat safek, lo shma hatra. Hatrat safek is not a good hatra. That would be hatrat safek, and you shouldn't be chayav at all. This relates to a position of Rabbi Yehuda later on, which is Rabbi Yehuda says, I don't know which leg has the Gita Nasheh. He says, I don't know if it's the right leg or the left leg that is subject to Gita Nasheh. He says, Misvara, I would say it's the right leg. But I don't have any proof to that. And therefore, he has a safek as to whether it's the right or the left leg. So now, if you had a single hatra'ah, and you ate both legs, the Gidon Asher from both legs, I understand why you're chayab once. Because bimanav shach, the hatra'ah worked. Because one of the two things you ate was covered by this hatra'ah, and therefore you're chayab arba'im. On the other hand, if it is that you had a hatra'ah, then you ate the right leg, and a hatra'ah, and you ate the left leg, according to Rabbi Yehuda, you're not going to be chayab then, because each hatra'ah is hatra'ah safek. Because you warn him and he eats the right leg, you don't know if he's eating Gidon Asher. Then you warn him and he eats the left leg, you also don't know if he's eating the Gidon Asher. It's a hatra'ah safek and it won't work. The Tanya, hika et zeh, v'chazar hika et zeh. If a person hits his father and then goes ahead and hits his father, it's an instance in which the woman did not wait between the time that she got divorced and remarried the requisite 3 months. The reason we want her to wait 3 months is to see if she's pregnant from the first marriage before she enters into the second marriage. So if she didn't wait that requisite 3 months and instead got married within 2 months, now she has a baby after 7 months of being married. We don't know if it's 9 months from the first husband or 7 months from the second husband. So the child that's born, it's a safek as to whether his father is the first husband or the father is the second husband. If he hits both of them, if you hit your parents, you're a chayav mita for it. Or if you curse your parents, you're a chayav mita for it. So here he has an uncertainty. If he hit this one, and then he hit the other one, or kileletzeh v'chazavi kileletzeh, or he cursed one and then cursed the other, or he hit both of them simultaneously, or he cursed both of them simultaneously, chayav. In all those cases, he's chayav mita. If it's done simultaneously, then he is chayav, because then there's no hatrat safek over there, because he gave a warning, and the individual did it. Mimonav shach, he hit his father in that case. Or mimonav shach, he cursed his father. But if he did it b'zeh chazeh, then the hatra'ah is a hatrat safek, because we're not certain as to whether, when you give him the warning, whether he hit his father, or he didn't hit his father. And each hatra'ah is a hatrat safek. When you warn him about the first one, we don't know if that's his father. We warn him about the second one, we don't know if it's his father. Elapshita b'bat achat u'b'hatra achat. Must be a scenario in which it is happening simultaneously, and there's one warning over here. So it's a case where achal kezayit, you're eating two kezayitim of Gidon Asher, simultaneously, one from the right leg, one from the left leg, and there's a single hatra. Don't eat Gidon Asher. And mimonav shach, you ate Gidon Asher over here. Uman Tana Kama. Now, who is the one that argues on Rabbi Yehuda in this case? Ilema Rabbonon de Poligale de Sumchus. If you think it's the Rabbonon that argue on Sumchus, Hashto Ma'otom de Gufim Mechulakim Patri Rabbonon. In a case where there's Gufim Mechulakim, the Rabbonon say, you're only Chayav once. Hachalo Koshkein. Over here, isn't it certainly so, where there's only either, again, Shem Echad, there's only one violation over here, or if you want to say there's no separate gufim over here, it's only one animal that you're eating to get a neshef from, then certainly shouldn't it only be chayav once? Elav sumchusi. It is authored by sumchus. And if it's sumchus now, you see that sumchus is michayev in multiple violations of the same problem, which is that here, if you were warned not to eat gidin asheh, and then you go ahead and eat gidin asheh twice, you're just going to be chayav two times for that, not just once for that. So you see that according to some quotes, even when there's a single shame, isur, and even one goof, nevertheless, you're chayav twice. And then that would be a proof to what Rabbi Yosef said is the position or the view of some quotes. Well, it says, lo, the olam b'zeh chazeh. It's a case where it was sequential. V'rabonon. And it is the position of the rabbonon and not some quotes. Baitana Savala ki idach tana de Rabbi Yehuda. And he holds like the other view of Rabbi Yehuda, damar hatra safek, shma hatra. That even when you give a hatra mi safek, it is a hatra. So now in that case, if it is hatra safek ishma hatra, then even b'zeh chazeh you can do it. Because according to Rabbi Yehuda, when you say it's a safek, and you don't know whether it's the right leg or the left leg that has gidin asheh, if you warn him the first time and he eats the right leg, then you warn him a second time and he eats the left leg, in that case, mimonav shach, he ate the gidin asheh. And each hatra'ah, even though it's hatra'ah safek, it is a good hatra'ah. If that's a good hatra'ah, then that's why you're chayav arba'im over here, because mimonav shach, we're in one violation. And then the rabbonon are going to be the authors of the reisha that say shmonim, because there were two hatra'ot over here. So even the rabbonon agree, when there are two hatra'ot, b'zeh chazeh, you're going to be chayav on each one of them, because they believe, number one, that the gidin asheh bites the right and the left. And number two is you had separate hatra'ot for each one of them, and there you're going to be chayav twice. The Tanya, because you have a bright to low to your menu at boker, and don't tell me menu at boker, but that you shouldn't leave over the notar, meaning the korban past the expiry date, till the morning. And that which is left over to the morning, you have to burn. Ba'katub di ten asay, achar lo tasay. The pasuk comes to teach you that there's an asay to rectify the lo tasay. Tomar shein lukin alav divi Rabbi Yehuda. That's why Rabbi Yehuda says you don't get malkot over here, because it is a lav hanitak li asay. Rabbi Yaakov Omer lo min hashem uzeh. That's not the reason why you don't get malkot over here. I'm sure that they love shame b'maaseh. It's because there's no action over here. It's a passive violation. Kol lav shame b'maaseh in lukim nalav. Anything that is a passive violation, you don't get malkot for. You have to be actively in violation to get malkot, not passive. Over here, all you did was not eat it before the expiry date, and that's why you don't get malkot. Because klotach som v'dishor v'dishor is juxtaposed to the din of malkot. And that's the paradigm of what gets malkot, and that includes a lav that doesn't have any takle asay, doesn't have a rectification through an asay, as well as a lav that has a maisa in it, and not a lav shein bo maase. And again, the Gemara in other places discusses why Rabbi Yehuda might disagree with the issue of lav shein bo maase. From here, the Gemara is midayek that Rabbi Yehuda thinks, number one, that lav shein bo maase lokin a lav, and that's why he went to lav and itakle asay, rather than lav shein bo maase. Number two is, you see from here, that hatrat safek would have been a good hatrat. Because over here, he says, had it not been for the fact that it was a lav and itak deaseh, you would have been chayav malkot. Well, by notar, it's always a hatrat safek. Because when you tell the person, if you don't eat it, you're going to have notar, at every moment in time, there's still more time left. So every time you warn him, then he says, I still have more time to eat it, or I have more time before it expires. And therefore, I can leave it over. I don't have to eat it right away. And every hatra is hatra safek, because you don't know if you eat it in between the hatra and the end. If you did it the last moment of the day, you did a hatra then, maybe it wouldn't be hatra safek. But to get it that exact and be perfect, we don't assume. So that means that Rabbi Yehuda thinks that hatra safek would have been sufficient. Given that, then we can explain the Gemara differently like we did before. And Tosfos points out that even though in the Gemara later on, it's going to say that Rabbi Yehuda believes it is the right side, he's saying the Gemara of Yer is entertaining according to that Havamina that Rabbi Yehuda was uncertain. Maybe we should be able to prove in that uncertainty the opinion of Sumchus. The Gemara says no, because it could be that Rabbi Yehuda doesn't believe that Hatrat Safek is a problem, and Hatrat Safek does work. If that's the case, even if Rabbi Yehuda in the Havamina thinks it's a Safek, you still can't prove the opinion of Sumchus in that scenario. Then the Gemara is going to move to the concluding position of Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda believes that it is the right side, and therefore, then we're going to bring a case here where the two gidim are coming from the right side of both animals. All right, Tashma. Akal shnei gidim mishtei yirekot mishtei behemot. If you eat two gidim from two different animals, Rashi says over here, "Minakat shtei behemot shmamina b'miniot kamar." That the shtei yirekot over here are not from two different sides of the animal, the same side of the animal. Sofeg shmoni, then you get 80 malkot. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, enu sofeg yela arba'im, you only get 40. So heichidami, again, what is the case? Ilim bezechar zeh b'shtei atra'ot. If you ate them separately, and there was hatra'ah between each of them, my time at the Rabbi Yehuda, damar arba'im betulo. Why does he say that you only get 40 and no more? You should get 80 here. And this is based on the shita that Rabbi Yehuda did know which leg it was. Even though he said, I don't know, he says, misfar, I think it's the right leg. So it's not according to the view in Rabbi Yehuda that's a safek, rather according to the view in Rabbi Yehuda that it is the right side. So here, if you ate the right side of the two different animals, and you got a shra for each one of them, according to Rabbi Yehuda, you should have been chayav for both of them. So my time to Rabbi Yehuda, amarim, betulo, elop, shita, bevat achat. So it's a case where you ate them together, ubachad hatra, and one hatra, man tanakama. So who's the tanakama that's going to say you're chayav 80 in that case? You ate two right legs of animals, and they're both gidin hashet, the same violation. So why would you be chayav twice? Ilim rabbonon de pligi alei de sumchus, it is authored by those rabbonon, ma hotam de gufim mechulakim patri rabbonon, hakalo koshkein. Over there where it's gufim mechulakim, again, it makes more sense if you say shemot, they're two different isurim. Over here, there's only one Isur of Gidin Hashem. If you say Gufim Mechulakim, over here, you do actually have Gufim Mechulakim. But even there, the Chachamim say, by Gufim Mechulakim, it doesn't matter. And so it's over here, maybe Gufim Mechulakim shouldn't matter. El Alav Sumchusi. You see there that Sumchus in a single Hatra is willing to have you violate multiple times and be Chayav for those multiple times. Mar says, look, Lo Olam B'Zeh Chazer. It is sequential. Amar, my time I do Rabbi Yehuda. So then what's the reasoning behind Rabbi Yehuda's position that you only get 40 and not 80? Could go on the lefe kezayit. There isn't a kezayit over here. The Tanya. Achlo veimbo kezayit chayav. If you eat it and there's no kezayit there, you are chayav. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, ajebo kezayit. Rabbi Yehuda says you need a kezayit in order to be chayav. And that's why you're only chayav 40. According to the Tanya Kamo, it's a biria b'fnei atzma. It's an entity unto itself. Therefore, you don't need a full kezayit. If you eat the gidin hasheh, that's what the Torah said is a sur. So if you eat gidin hasheh, you're chayav. So even though both of them are less than a kezayit, you are chayav for each one of them for a gidin hasheh. According to Rabbi Yehuda, you need it to add up to a kezayit. And therefore, when you eat the two of them, they add up to a kezayit, and that's why you're chayav. Now, Rashi says he heard that explanation and thinks it's wrong. Says, v'einire v'einai. I don't think that's correct. She shtei hatrot mitzarfot. So over here, you have two separate hatrot. So even if one is a chatzi kezayit and one's a chatzi kezayit, and they add up to a kezayit, but each one was a separate hatra, they're not one hatra. That's the case, they shouldn't be able to be mitzarif. And if you tell me that it's a case where you ate it within kedei achila pras, which is usually the ability to join things together, then that's called badachat, that's not called zechazeh. Vilachar kedei achila pras, tulo mitzarfe, then they are not mitzarif. And therefore, the reason that Rabbi Yehuda says you're only chayav arba'im over here is because one of them had a kezayit and the other one didn't have a kezayit. So the one that had a kezayit you are chayav for. The one that you didn't have a kezayit in, you're not going to be chayav for. Whereas the Tanna Kama says you're going to be chayav for both of them because he doesn't have the threshold of kezayit by gidin hasheh because it's a biria b'fnei atzma, it's chashuv by itself, and that's enough to make you chayav in malkot. The Rishonim, like the Ramban, disagree with this view in Rashi and say that the hatra'ah should not be an interrupter or a problem. So the truth is that it is b'kedei achilat pras, which would make it bevat achat. And the chiddush here is that the hatra'ah, the second hatra'ah, does not interfere with the first hatra'ah to make him chayav. But the chiddush is also on the other side, which is that if he ate a full amount for the first one and a full amount for the second one, even though it's within k'dei achilat pras, if there's a hatra'ah in between, that second hatra'ah is effective in making chayav twice. And therefore they disagree with Rashi's view here that one of them was a kezayit, one was sub-kezayit. They say both were sub-kezayit. And the truth is that they are able to be added together, even though they're in the kedei achilat pras, which would quote-unquote make them bevat achat, The point is that there was a hachra'ah in between, which you might have thought would separate them, and they call it b'zeh chazeh because of that hachra'ah in between. Nevertheless, since it was b'teachilat pras, that's enough to make it into a single entity. Okay, we're going to stop here by the Mishnah on the top of Pei Gimel, Amud Aleph.